Thank you for joining us again in our study of the Life Divine. We're in the last chapter of Sri Aurobindo's magnum opus, the 28th. It's called The Divine Life. Sri Aurobindo, when we left off, was describing that the Gnostic being, no longer being subject to the rules of ordinary nature, but bringing forward and exhibiting extraordinary powers that are always held concealed within, which are native to the being of Satchit Ananda, and which must emerge through the course of through the course of evolution, have to be reflected first in our own being. We must recover fully what we are as true selves, that selfhood that we find in ourselves is identical to the selfhood of those in others. And so we will not only have knowledge and power harmonized and harnessed within our own being, but in a wider collectivity, the same self is in governance. So all will be able to work with all, each deputized to fulfill a particular action according to the divine will in harmony with all others, not in conflict, not in a chaos of competition. And then, of course, that we would be aware of the forces and the energies emerging from within us. And finally, we would have a mastery of the inner machinery of the cosmos. So this insistence that the soul is sovereign over the nature comes to full fruition in the manifestation of the Gnostic being, both in individual form and in the collective. And the individual is that which unites the transcendent with the cosmic. In the individual is stationed all these realities. So we pick it up. A new power and powers of consciousness would be then an inevitable consequence of an evolution of consciousness force, passing beyond mind to a superior cognitive and dynamic principle. In their essential nature, these new powers must have the character of a control of mind over life and matter, of the conscious life will and life force over matter, of the spirit over mind, life, and matter. They would have the character also of a breaking down of the barriers between soul and soul, mind and mind, life and life. Such a change would be indispensable for the instrumentation of the Gnostic life. And as he described earlier in the Life Divine, the wall that separates us from the world outside and the wall that separates us from the subliminal inside must all come down. Both must be removed. And we move fluidly from the space in our soul through the whole cosmos, inner and outer. Here too, this problem of intersubjectivity, not knowing what the other person feels or thinks or sees, has to disappear in the arrival of a Gnostic consciousness, because this is based on self, a self that identifies with the same self in another form, and so contains within itself innately all the content that's in the other, all it need do is peer to see, to exercise its intuitive power. And there, It's delivered. What is the truth? For a total Gnostic or divine living would include not only the individual life of the being, but the life of others, made one with the individual in a common uniting consciousness. Such a life must have for its main constituting power a spontaneous and innate, not a constructed, unity and harmony. This can only come by a greater identity of being and consciousness between individual and individual, unified in their spiritual substance, feeling themselves to be self and self of one self-existence, acting in a greater unitarian force of knowledge, a greater power of the being. So one in perception, pure in power. Authentically arising, because consciousness and being are the same, the Gnostic consciousness delivers the living truth of Satchit Ananda to our daily experience. It's the wonder of it, isn't it? And by the way, common uniting consciousness, I think we mentioned last time that the Rig Veda closes in the 10th mandala, 191st hymn, with that refrain about commonness. And here's the English: common be your counsel, common your assembly, common your mind and your thoughts, common be your will, common your hearts, common your spirits, that you may long dwell in unity and concord. So this is the closing hymn from the Rig Veda, thousands of years ago, seeing already a unified soul life in the individual and in the collectivity and in the society. He continues, there must be an inner and direct mutual knowledge based upon a consciousness of oneness and identity, a consciousness of each other's being, thought, feeling, inner and outer movements, a conscious communication of mind with mind, of heart with heart, a conscious impact of life upon life, a conscious interchange of forces of being with forces of being. In any absence or deficiency of these powers and their intimate light, there could not be a real or complete unity or a real and complete natural fitting of each individual's being, thought, feeling, inner and outer movements with those of the individuals around him. A growing basis and structure of conscious unanimism, we might say, would be the character of this more evolved life. Unanimity. What flows from that oneness? Harmony is the natural rule of the spirit. It is the inherent law and spontaneous consequence of unity in multiplicity, of unity in diversity, of a various manifestation of oneness. In a pure and blank unity, there could be indeed no place for harmony, for there is nothing to harmonize. In a complete or a governing diversity, there must be either discord or a fitting together of differences, a constructed harmony. So you see on the one side, the typical view of Atman, the self, aloof in itself, unmoving, no distinction between subject and object, no diversity apparent. In the other, the problem of mental discord arises. So, the supramental, of course, harmonizes oneness and diversity. But in a Gnostic unity, in multiplicity, the harmony would be there as a spontaneous expression of the unity. And this spontaneous expression presupposes a mutuality of consciousness, aware of other consciousness, by a direct inner contact and interchange. So again, knowledge and power. In infrarational life, harmony is secured by an instinctive oneness of nature and oneness of the action of the nature, an instinctive communication, an instinctive or direct vital intuitional sense understanding by which the individuals of an animal or insect community are able to cooperate. In human life, this is replaced by understanding through sense knowledge and mental perception and communication of ideas by speech, and the means that have to be used are imperfect, and the harmony and cooperation incomplete. In a Gnostic life, a life of super reason and super nature, a self-aware spiritual unity of being and a spiritual conscious community and interchange of nature would be the deep and ample root of understanding. This greater life would have evolved new and superior means and powers of uniting consciousness inwardly with consciousness. Intimacy of consciousness, communicating inwardly and directly with consciousness, thought with thought, vision with vision, sense with sense, life with life, body awareness with body awareness would be its natural basic instrumentation. All these new powers taking up the old outward instruments and using them as a subordinate means with a far greater power and to more purpose would be put to the service of the self-expression of the spirit in a profound oneness of being and life. It's worth noting that this experience of oneness in the sovereignty of this Gnostic consciousness chords harmonically through the whole being. The mind sees oneness. The life feels oneness. The body itself vibrates with oneness. All parts of the being, under the sway of the Gnostic consciousness, participate in this grand symphonic harmony. An evolution of innate and latent, but as yet unevolved powers of consciousness is not considered admissible by the modern mind because these exceed our present formulation of nature and to our ignorant preconceptions founded on a limited experience. They seem to belong to the supernatural, to the miraculous and occult. For they surpass the known action of material energy, which is now ordinarily accepted as the sole cause and mode of things and the sole instrumentation of the world force. A human working of marvels by the conscious being discovering and developing an instrumentation of material forces, overpassing anything that nature has herself organized, is accepted as a natural fact and an almost unlimited prospect of our existence. An awakening, a discovery, an instrumentation of powers of consciousness and of spiritual, mental, and life forces, overpassing anything that nature or man has yet organized, is not admitted as possible. So we can plumb the depths of material being and harness those previously undisclosed energies to our betterment and illuminate our houses and condition our air, etc. But we could never find untapped psychological powers and bring them to the fore, could we? And his argument here is, of course, that a future evolution will not have to obey the laws of the past. But there would be nothing supernatural or miraculous in such an evolution, except insofar as it would be a supernature or superior nature to ours, just as human nature is a supernature or superior nature to that of animal or plant or material objects. His familiar logic by analogy here. Our mind and its powers, our use of reason, our mental intuition and insight, speech, possibilities of philosophical, scientific, aesthetic discovery of the truths and potencies of being, and the control of its forces, are an evolution that has taken place. Yet it would seem impossible if we took our stand on the limited animal consciousness and its capacities, for there is nothing there to warrant so prodigious a progression. So given our animal basis, there's no reason to predict that the human with its many powers would be able to manifest. But still, there are vague initial manifestations, rudimentary elements or arrested possibilities in the animal to which our reason and intelligence, with their extraordinary developments, stand as an unimaginable journey from a poor and unpromising point of departure. The rudiments of spiritual powers, belonging to the Gnostic supernature, are similarly there, even in our ordinary composition, but only occasionally and sparsely active. It is not irrational to suppose that at this much higher stage of the evolution, a similar but greater progression, starting from these rudimentary beginnings, might lead to another immense development and departure. So we may seem modest and altogether too human, but there could be something divine sleeping within us, waiting for its emergence. In mystic experience, when there is an opening of the inner centers, or in other ways, spontaneously or by will or endeavor, or in the very course of the spiritual growth, new powers of consciousness have been known to develop. They present themselves as if an automatic consequence of some inner opening or an answer to a call in the being, so much so that it has been found necessary to recommend to the seeker not to hunt after these powers, not to accept or use them. One thinks of the late 1920s in the ashram, when, because of the force of the sadhana as it was developing in the small community there, greater powers were precipitating into some of the sadhaks than they were sufficiently prepared to receive. And there were sudden revelations of godheads in them, extraordinary powers that were manifesting. But as we'll see, Sri Aurobindo is writing a long paragraph here to treat this general issue as to whether to accept, develop, and use these powers or not. His main argument is that one must be prepared, and they are not foreign to the true integral spiritual life. This rejection, he writes, is logical for those who seek to withdraw from life, for all acceptance of greater power would bind to life or be a burden on the bare and pure urge towards liberation. Well, this seems to be true of those brands of spiritual life in India which turn away from the world, culminating in Adi Shankara and Advaita Vedanta. But even in the Yoga Sutras, which is a few centuries earlier, you see that there is a recognition and at least a limited acceptance of the utility of these awakening powers, which we would call siddhis. We do not find, virtually at any point in tantric development, a similar wholesale exclusion of the exploration of these hidden powers of the being. They are intended to be controlled, mastered, and fulfilled, which is what siddhi means, isn't it? Fulfillment. And in deference to all other aims and issues is natural for the God lover who seeks God for his own sake and not for power or any inferior attraction. The pursuit of these alluring but often dangerous forces would be a deviation from his purpose. A similar rejection is a necessary self-restraint and a spiritual discipline for the immature seeker, since such powers may be a great, even a deadly peril. For their supernormality may easily feed in him an abnormal exaggeration of the ego. And I think I can leave names aside, but there were at least two prominent figures in the early life of the ashram who eventually had to leave because they experienced such an imbalance. And one was asked simply to calm, extricate, go back to the ordinary life. No longer was the vehicle able to sustain or receive these greater powers. And what looked like might be a marvelous awakening in him became a rupture, a sort of cleavage in his being which couldn't be healed. In another case, a person became so egocentric that he thought that he would be able to carry forward the supramental evolution with a quicker and more sovereign pace if only Mother and Sri Aurobindo would step aside and let him work. So he too left the ashram and was not able to recover the forward force of his progress. And so one hopes that they will be picked up again in the future. But one has to be ready. You don't go pulling upon forces. They'll come to you when you're ready. I leave aside the mention of those who today think that without the guidance of Mother and Sri Aurobindo that they are avid and ready to manifest the supramental in all its glory. Power in itself may be dreaded as a temptation by the aspirant to perfection, because power can abase as well as elevate. Nothing is more liable to misuse. But when new capacities come as an inevitable result of the growth into a greater consciousness and a greater life, and that growth is part of the very aim of the spiritual being within us, this bar does not operate. For a growth of the being into supernature and its life in supernature cannot take place or cannot be complete without bringing with it a greater power of consciousness and a greater power of life and the spontaneous development of an instrumentation of knowledge and force normal to that supernature. So what we call siddhis must emerge. There is nothing in this future evolution of the being which could be regarded as irrational or incredible. There is nothing in it abnormal or miraculous. It would be the necessary course of the evolution of consciousness and its forces in the passage from the mental to the Gnostic or supramental formulation of our existence. This action of the forces of supernature would be a natural, normal, and spontaneously simple working of the new, higher or greater consciousness into which the being enters in the course of his self-evolution. The Gnostic being, accepting the Gnostic life, would develop and use the powers of this greater consciousness, even as man develops and uses the powers of his mental nature. It is evident that such an increase of the power or powers of consciousness would be not only normal but indispensable to a greater and more perfect life. Human life, with its partial harmony, insofar as that is not maintained by the imposition of a settled law and order on the constituent individuals through a partly willing, partly induced, partly forced, or unavoidable acceptance, reposes on the agreement of the enlightened or interested elements in their mind, heart, life sense, and assent to a composite body of common ideas, desires, vital satisfactions, aims of existence, the ordinary human life. But there is, in the mass of constituting individuals, an imperfect understanding and knowledge of the ideas, life aims, life motives which they have accepted, an imperfect power in their execution, an imperfect will to maintain them always unimpaired, to carry them out fully, or to bring the life to a greater perfection. There is an element of struggle and discord, a mass of repressed or unfulfilled desires and frustrated wills, a simmering, suppressed unsatisfaction, or an awakened or eruptive discontent of unequally satisfied interests. There are new ideas, life motives that break in and cannot be correlated without upheaval and disturbance. There are life forces at work in human beings and their environment that are at variance with the harmony that has been constructed, and there is not the full power to overcome the discord and dislocations created by a clashing diversity of mind and life and by the attack of disrupting forces in universal nature. What is lacking is a spiritual knowledge and spiritual power, a power over self, a power born of inner unification with others, a power over the surrounding or invading world forces, a full visioned and fully equipped power of effectuation of knowledge. It is these capacities missing or defective in us that belong to the very substance of Gnostic being, for they are inherent in the light and dynamis of the Gnostic nature. So here he speaks of the oneness of the self, able to enforce itself and its truths on the whole that embody it, in the individual, in the collective as well. And remember, Sri Aurobindo is always writing with echoing effect back to the ashram, which is the first readership of the life divine. Here is what we're about. Here is what we're trying to achieve. And do we really want to remain human? Are we not ready as a community to aspire and ascend to a new divine life? Well, if we want to do that, then we have to give up ego. We have to give up desire. We have to unite at every level. Common be your mantra. Common your purpose. But in addition to the imperfect accommodation of the minds, hearts, lives of the constituting individuals in a human society, the mind and the life of the individual himself are actuated by forces that are not in accord with each other. Our attempts to accord them are imperfect, and still more imperfect is our force to put any one of them into integral or satisfying execution in life. Thus, the law of love and sympathy is natural to our consciousness. As we grow in spirit, its demand on us increases. But there is also the demand of the intellect, the push of the vital force and its impulses in us, the claim and pressure of many other elements that do not coincide with the law of love and sympathy. Nor do we know how to fit them all into the whole law of existence or to render any or all of them either justly or entirely effective or imperative. In order to make them concordant and actively fruitful in the whole being and whole life, we have to grow into a more complete spiritual nature. We have, by that growth, to live in the light and force of a higher and larger and more integral consciousness, of which knowledge and power, love and sympathy, and play of life will are all natural and ever-present accorded elements. We have to move and act in a light of truth which sees intuitively and spontaneously the thing to be done and the way to do it, and intuitively and spontaneously fulfills itself in the act and the force, taking up into that intuitive spontaneity of their truth, into its simple spiritual and supreme normality, the complexity of our forces of being, and suffusing with their harmonized realities all the steps of nature. This is Beethoven. This is Mozart. This is wonderful. What a grand invitation. It's pretty plain in what he says, when he says that we have to grow into our spiritual nature, that he means that super nature, not simply the inner recognition of oneself in all, not simply the psychological verity of that, but the empowered truth of that vision, of that identity of consciousness. That only comes when we open the portals above and allow that supernature to flood into us and emerge from within and from behind. It is ready to act in and through the person who is willing to live without ego, who is willing to live without that absolute centration of the self against the world, the self against all. But it has to be empowered. The force of being, the chit shakti, has to manifest. Not simply the recognition of sat being. Sat chit ananda. Sat and chit must work to manifest. The ananda is the outflow. It should be evident that no rationalized piecing together or ingenuity of mental construction can accord or harmonize this complexity. It is only the intuition and self-knowledge of an awakened spirit that can do it. That would be the nature of the evolved supramental being and his existence. His spiritual sight and sense would take up all the forces of the being in a unifying consciousness and bring them into a normality of accorded action, accord, everything working together. For this accord and concord are the true normality of the spirit, The discord, the disharmony of our life and nature, is abnormal to it, although it is normal to the life of the ignorance. It is indeed because it is not normal to the spirit that a knowledge within us is dissatisfied and strives towards a greater harmony in our existence. We had occasion to note long back this Zen insight from Japan that all beings in nature live in a kind of satori, that they're happy, they're content with their state of being. Only the human is not. Well, Sri Aurobindo puts it differently. The human is the most dissatisfied and restless figure in a life form because the soul in us is powerful enough to want to shake off the shackles of ignorance and move beyond darkness into light, into true being away from non-being, into a deathless state away from being chained to the passage of transient forms. This accord and concord of the whole being, which is natural to the Gnostic individual, would be equally natural to a community of Gnostic beings, for it would rest on a union of self with self in the light of a common and mutual self-awareness. It is true that in the total terrestrial existence of which the Gnostic life would be a part, there would be still continuing within it a life belonging to a less evolved order. The intuitive and Gnostic life would have to fit into this total existence and carry into it as much of its own law of unity and harmony as may be possible. Yes, we do not annihilate ignorance around us by becoming enlightened. We coexist with it, but we carry light into it, isn't it? Here, the law of spontaneous harmony might seem to be inapplicable, since the relation of the Gnostic life with the ignorant life around it would not be founded on a mutuality of self-knowledge and a sense of one being and common consciousness. It would be a relation of action of knowledge to action of ignorance. But this difficulty need not be so great as it seems now to us, for the Gnostic knowledge would carry in it a perfect understanding of the consciousness of the ignorance, and it would not be impossible, therefore, for an assured Gnostic life to harmonize its existence with that of all the less developed life coexistent with it in the earth nature. So, it finds a way even to harmonize its effulgent life with what seems to be gathered darkness about. Slowly, slowly, the light grows greater in the east. So I think let's put a bookmark there and we'll come back and resume our reading next week. This is a section from Savitri, which I think actually is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 14, The World's Soul. And while it describes a state inwards to our view, it is something that we must eventually in a Gnostic life manifest from the consciousness all the way to the flesh. All here was known by a spiritual sense. Thought was not there, but a knowledge near and one seized on all things by a moved identity, a sympathy of self with other selves, the touch of consciousness on consciousness, and being's look on being with inmost gaze, and heart laid bare to heart without walls of speech, and the unanimity of seeing minds in myriad forms luminous with the one God. Life was not there, but an impassioned force, finer than fineness, deeper than the deeps, felt as a subtle and spiritual power, a quivering out from soul to answering soul, a mystic movement, a close influence, a free and happy and intense approach of being to being with no screen or check, without which life and love could never have been. Body was not there, for bodies were needed not. The soul itself was its own deathless form, and met at once the touch of other souls, close, blissful, concrete, wonderfully true. As when one walks in sleep through luminous dreams, and conscious knows the truth their figures mean, here, where reality was its own dream, he knew things by their soul and not their shape. As those who have lived long, made one in love, need word nor sign for heart's reply to heart, he met and communed without bar of speech with beings unveiled by a material frame. There was a strange spiritual scenery, a loveliness of lakes and streams and hills, a flow, a fixity in a soul space, and plains and valleys, stretches of soul joy, and gardens that were flower tracks of the spirit, its meditations of tinged reverie. Air was the breath of a pure infinite. A fragrance wandered in a colored haze, as if the scent and hue of all sweet flowers had mingled to copy heaven's atmosphere. Appealing to the soul and not the eye, beauty lived there at home in her own house. There, all was beautiful by its own right and needed not the splendor of a robe. All objects were like bodies of the gods, a spirit symbol environing a soul, for world and self were one reality. Namaste, Jai Ma.